Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
I'm your host, Jordana Levine. This is a very special episode that I was dying to get up to showcase a very good friend of mine, but to also let you know about an epic Kickstarter campaign she's running. And guys, she needs your help. Rachel Coops is an actor, yoga teacher, play school presenter, writer, and creative who has most recently written and produced a kids' television series that encourages the use of imagination. It invites kids to engage with nature and their surroundings, and that introduces little ones to the concepts and principles of yoga. The same principles that have changed so many adult yogi lives. The show, Rachel and the Minis, have an epic pilot episode that they've recorded, but Rach needs your help to create the rest of the series. In this conversation, we talk about what it's like working as an actor in LA during pilot season. We go behind the scenes of everyone's favorite childhood TV show, Play School. We talk about yoga and the importance of normalizing the philosophies of this ancient practice to make it relatable and practical to modern yogis. And we explore the importance of creating Rachel and the Minis, which encourages kids to move their bodies, use their imagination, and try new things while learning and laughing along the way. I hope you enjoy this conversation with my good friend Rachel Coops. And if you can help out in any way at all with her Kickstarter campaign, please head to the link in the show notes. As always, if you enjoyed this episode, take a screenshot on your phone, share it to your Instagram stories, and tag me at Jordana Levine, and tag Rachel at Rachel Coops. That's RachaelCoops. I want to say that I know you as my yoga teacher, but the truth is, Rach, I was watching you on McLeod Daughters.
Yeah.
Before then. And it only clicked a few years ago. I was like, oh no.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. This is why Rach looks so familiar when I started doing her classes.
Oh, that's so funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I'm back. Being back in LA at the moment actually has been really interesting because it's like my, you know, this was a past life here for me when I was on such a trajectory and I'm so focused and so like just doing the thing and like really trying to make it happen. And
yeah,
it's so been really
was the focus always acting for you?
Acting and writing.
Yeah.
Mm.
And was that was that like from a really young age? Was that like a high school thing or?
You know, it was a high school thing, but I always thought I'd outgrow it when I was at high school because I was very academic. Yeah. So, and I was very, I think coming from that kind of, you know, we didn't have a lot of money growing up. We're coming from that kind of background of there's no way, it was too frivolous.
Yeah.
Like you just had to get a job and especially if you had a brain. So I went to Sydney Uni, I did a commerce degree thinking I would just end up getting over acting. But then I basically supported myself through uni by acting.
Yeah.
And then I was like, you know, spent 6 months in corporate. I got headhunted by Fairfax. So we got straight into this, you know, great job at Fairfax in sales and marketing and spent 6 months full time and just was like, this can't be my life. I can't do it. I was so miserable. I was covered in psoriasis. I was really good at it, but I was miserable. And so
are you naturally drawn to numbers? Like, do you enjoy numbers?
No.
No. I was going to say. No. I don't know many writers that do enjoy numbers.
No, but in retrospect, it was very much what I love. What I love is taking really complex things and making sense of them.
Yeah.
So, like, the subjects I excelled in were industrial relations and economic history. Like, I loved economic history, like understanding how the world's economic state was affecting fashion choices and birth rates. And, like, I do love lots of complex information and then trying to figure it out. Mm. But I was terrible at econometrics. I failed. It's like the only thing in my life I failed. And then when I did it the next year, because it's the statistics ones you have to pass for Sydney Uni Economics. And when the second time I only just scraped through.
Yeah, wow. And what did it feel like to fail for the first time?
I think I was okay with it because I was okay with it. Like, I didn't want to be good at it. Like, I want to be good at everything else. But I was it definitely made me go, oh, maybe I should not do uni. Like, throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Yeah. Oh, I know that feeling. Okay, so you started acting to earn money while you were at uni.
Yeah.
And you thought, well, hang on a second, I quite enjoy this.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what was the acting experience like for you?
I was not like the kid at school who was the lead in the play, ever.
Yeah, okay.
Never. I was always like the support. I was not like I loved Shakespeare and I was quite competitive in debating and the Shakespeare competition and anything that was a little bit academic in nature, I guess, of public speaking. Mm. But definitely not, it wasn't. It was more after I started to do it and then I was like, oh, this is actually really fun, you know. Yeah. Being on set's fun. Being in a theatre is fun and kind of and like for type A personalities, there's no control, right? So it's challenging.
Absolutely. Yeah. So you started off, did you start off in theatre?
Started off doing film.
Yeah.
And then did quite a bit of TV and kind of circled back to theatre a little bit later.
Okay. And and this was all happening in Australia at the time. Yeah. But did you go over to LA, do pilot season? Yeah. Like, did you do all of that?
Yeah.
Yeah. What was that like?
That was amazing. It was so amazing, but very was a very disciplined time in my life because it was, I think there's an illusion when you're that age and you're in LA, you're like sitting around drinking coffee and that was not my experience. I was like watching what I ate, exercising like a maniac and just auditioning. You might audition, you know, three times a day. And so you just learn, all you're doing is learning lines and like it's work. It's work. But I hear that now it's a bit different. Like it's changed just because the television landscape's changed and pretty much there's no just pilot season now. It's like all year round. It's just a different world. But when I did it was, you'd come out for 3 to 6 months, you'd hit it hard, spend all the money you'd earned back in Australia, go back, start again.
Yeah, okay, so was that how it worked? You had to earn all the money before you went over there and then you just spent 6 months auditioning until you ran out of money and then you have to come home.
Then you have to come home.
Yeah, and was your goal, what was your acting goal? Like what did you want to achieve?
I think this is probably why I ended up letting it go, to be honest, is I think beyond, like I just loved being on set and I loved playing dress up and I loved storytelling, but I didn't have a real hankering beyond that. Like it wasn't like I had aspirations to be on a particular drama. People would often say to me, oh, what would be your dream show to be on? And I'm like, I don't know. I mean, I guess at a stretch, the SNL girls, like I always loved Tina Fey and Amy Poehler back in the day.
Yeah.
But they were great. But I definitely didn't have ambitions to be someone or on a particular thing. So, but I knew that you had to do that. You had to just keep you had to get to a certain level if you were ever going to survive, because there's no kind of middle ground here. Whereas in Australia, you can sort of have a career and do other stuff and work, and it's no all or nothing, you know. Mm. Well, I don't know. I mean, maybe it is for some people. Maybe that's a perception as well of what. But yes, I definitely was missing that gene of, I would die for it. Yeah. You know, like. I would do anything to get it, because I didn't have a vision of what it was.
Exactly. And I mean, that's like anything in life, right? But I think the people that like really make it and really stick it out, and of course there are those few, those lucky few that just get a break, they're really dedicated to it, right? They're dedicated to the cause. It becomes their life. Yeah. So if you're not in it, you're not in it. I completely understand.
Yeah, and I think there was not a real dream for me either of living in LA, the city. Like LA, the city it's so fun. There's so much great stuff here. But it's not like people don't dream of raising their families in LA, let's be honest. Like it's a lifestyle that for me it's very much a working kind of highly creative. This is the other fallacy though. Like I know a lot of people say, oh, it's so superficial. I'm like, it is and it isn't, because there is of course an element that is that, but there is the majority of people are sacrificing their lives and giving up so much to be here. And if they are, they are at the top of their game, most of them, right? They are like the best singers, the best musicians, the best actors, the best writers, and they are sacrificing like a lifestyle and time with family and friends to be here, to, because they have this burning desire in them to tell a story. Mm. And that's a really kind of very unique thing about LA, I think.
I've never been to LA, and I think that I've definitely bought into the story of it being really superficial and you know, all the glitz and glamour of Hollywood, and it's kind of really turned me off until quite recently, when I've heard more stories like the one that you're telling about, you know, the people that are there who are dedicated to their dreams, and they're all there in this like really condensed environment, all working towards these like major goals. I mean, there's some good vibes to be around, I think.
Yeah, and people aren't, as I said, people are not, you know, like we were speaking about before, that Byron and Sydney are great cities and there's so many opportunities, but you can also get a little bit lost in the kind of, I'll just have one more swim.
Guilty. Like,
you know, whereas people in LA work really, really hard.
Yeah.
And they're not here to muck around, you know, they're here to live their dreams. Mm. And there's something very, it's quite magnetic in that way.
So you're in LA at the moment. We didn't mention that before, but you're in LA on a holiday at the moment, and you've been hanging out with some of your friends who I assume are still in the industry.
Yeah. Some of they're all in the industry in some way, but as we've all got older, I think it changes too. Like I'm not surrounded by people who are here for pilot season, that's for sure.
They're quite well established. Do they have families? Are they raising families in LA?
Yeah, some of them have moved out a little bit. Like I've done some pretty long Uber drives since I've been here.
Yeah.
Valley, which wasn't the case when, you know, years ago. So they move out of LA a little bit. Some of them have moved to like San Fran.
Okay.
I think that's way more family friendly and still quite close to LA to do what you need to do. And some of them are still right in town doing their thing. But those friends aren't as much the ones with kids. Most of my friends with kids have moved out a bit, just a little bit.
Okay. So you came home from LA, and what happened next?
Well, the last trip. So the last time I got back was, I was a little bit older, so I went through my 20s, and then I moved to Paris. I studied theatre in Paris, and I lived there for 3 years. And at the end of that trip, I came to LA, and I was going to stay. I had no desire to go back to Sydney, and I was going to absolutely stay. And that trip was a real shock to me, because up until that point, I'd always auditioned, I'd always been really busy, but two things had changed. First thing was I was a bit older. So, and when I say a bit older, I mean like 30.
Oh, God.
So, yeah, I was an old lady there. They were like, why have you been in Paris for 3 years? And I'm like, studying my craft is why.
Yeah.
trying to get better at doing what I do. And it was, so part of it was that that had changed. And I was now the old lady in LA. And the other thing that had changed was me, because I'd spent 3 years in Europe and I'd spent 3 years in Paris. And I think I'd been working with, I was at an international theater school and working with directors and writers and actors from all over the world to create really beautiful pieces of theater. And I just changed. I didn't have the same desire to be shopping myself, my wares. Something had just shifted. So during that trip, I got McLeod's. And it was a really great – I'd put something down on tape here. I didn't get the job because this is the way how it rolls. It's always so funny. Didn't get the job, and then they changed their mind like 2 days before.
Yeah, wow.
And flew me out in a panic, so I had to pack my life. I basically left everything here thinking I'd come back, and I just never came back. I got back to Australia, I did McLeod's the last two seasons, and I did my teacher training as well then.
Okay, so that's where yoga came in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was like, after Paris, I just needed more. I just needed more.
Interesting.
And McLeod's being, you know, on a series, I'd always really wanted that to be on a series, and it was everything that I thought I wanted, and I was doing it all. And I just had this little hankering in my heart for being back in Europe, just writing, sitting in my little apartment writing, and yeah, I just was hungry for more. It wasn't enough.
And so what instigated the yoga teacher training?
I'd been a yogi, very dedicated yogi, for a long time, mainly Ashtangi. And I was just really hungry. I'd always read the philosophy, and I was just hungry to know more about why I felt, well, why yoga felt like my life, I guess. And Idit, who runs Sukhamukha in Sydney, was at that time at Samadhi in Newtown, and she was like, you should do it, you're gonna love it, you should do it. We were friends at the time, and you know, like, yoga teacher training always happens at that moment in life when it's just the perfect moment. And so I signed up really thinking I'd deepen my practice, and not that I would be a teacher, and get to dive into some of the philosophy a bit more, and I just fell in love with it. And it was very much that moment of going, I know now, like, what I can do. Because a lot of the jobs that I'd done before to keep myself surviving as an artist were temporary. And I was like, this is what I'm always going to do now for the rest of my life. I just knew. I knew that I would be able to grow and learn and love it. And it could be a big part of my life, not just a way to earn money.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as one of your students, I can't imagine you as anything but a yoga teacher. I mean, you're so much more than a yoga teacher, but I wonder if this is something that you've noticed in other teachers. I always notice that teachers with an acting background, like you, like Amy, have this real way of communicating to their students through class that just feels really different to other teachers. It's almost like there's this channel that you guys can access through your voice that doesn't always come across with other teachers. Have you noticed that?
Look, I think, you know, you're talking about my philosophy wife, Amy.
Yeah.
And so, of course, I know and I love her so deeply. And someone like Amy is a good example of, she's, I think, as storytellers, one part of it is being able to absolutely kind of express things in a particular way and communicate things in a way. We've had to spend our lives, two decades, both of us, communicating really beautiful ideas and concepts, and in a way that is engaging for people, right? And so, and we both love the philosophy part of yoga, I think, partly because you can go into it in your own individual way. So just like if you write a story or you're performing Hamlet, there's 5 billion Hamlets, right? And it's the same thing. You take one of the sutras or you take one of the goddess stories, and every single person's journey into it and then ability to communicate that is going to be so different, obviously. Mm. But if you're passionate about how you can express those things and communicate those things, then I think it shows. And then the other side of it is, you know, being an actor is pretty rigorous. There is so much training in terms of voice and in terms of just letting go of your stuff. Like, you have to be so vulnerable. You have to be so, and it's not about you. Like, the work is just never about you. Mm. You're very much part of a collaborative process, and everyone recognizes that. Yes, there's narcissism in the industry, but at the end of the day, at the core of it, everyone knows they are this one little cog in this giant machine. Mm. And so in order to create something really beautiful, one has to leave their egos at the door. And I think as an actor, you have to be, like my teacher, Philippe Gaulier, used to always say, the only job you have to do as an actor is show your soul. just a
simple
thing, right?
Thing. Yeah.
But I think that is not dissimilar to the process of yoga, right? And the ability to encourage our students to strip back and be so incredibly vulnerable, and yet at the same time so incredibly resilient, because you have to be resilient, you know. Life is challenging, and as an actor and a writer, you are going to be rejected many thousands and thousands of times, but you have to find a way to keep getting up there and then just shedding your skin and showing your soul to the world.
Yeah.
So there's something, I guess, in that. But we're probably fortunate to have years and years of kind of voice and creativity and storytelling under our belts as well.
Yeah, and a little bit of performance as well. I mean, it just keeps your mm-hmm. keeps your audience engaged while they're in their downward dog. No, but you do have a really beautiful way of explaining the philosophy of yoga, because I think that it can get very lost on students. It gets very lost on me, and I've studied it myself, and I really value the way that you and Amy manage to weave it in a way that's very relatable and very practical, because at the end of the day, we need to be able to take those philosophies out into the real world.
Yeah, and I think that's really what I get excited about, because when I first was teaching the philosophy in Bondi, and I know Amy was the same, like, the yogis there were not interested in it. They were really not interested. Like, it was like, who's this little blonde woman who talks all the freaking time? And I was not popular. You know, people weren't coming to my class apart from some of you diehards and who were kind of really interested in some of the deeper yogic concepts. Mm. But now, like, they love it. Mm. There's this real, I think people are hungry. People are hungry for self-knowledge.
Yeah.
People are hungry for more. Across the board, people are hungry for community. People are hungry to understand who and what they really are. They're hungry to know how they can be more powerful. The beauty of what you do with all of your manifestation work and work with the moon too. It's like they're hungry for understanding nature and the cycles of nature and our own inner power. So I think it's also the environment is shifting, I think, in terms of students. Our students are becoming really good students and really interested students and really excited students.
Mm.
And they want it. They want all the juicy stuff.
Yeah, totally. I'm there for the juicy stuff. It's so funny, actually, like, being up in Byron, the yoga scene up here is not what you would think. Like, it's very much, well, and maybe it's just the schools that I'm going to, but there's no philosophy at all, like, not at all. It's very much about coming for an hour's worth of exercise. And it's been really eye-opening to me, because I think I really took it for granted in Sydney, you know, like, and then again, maybe it was just the bubble I lived in Sydney, but yeah, it's just not really on offer up here. It's been quite interesting to observe.
Yeah. LA's been a bit the same. There's one teacher here who's great and a really interesting, and you know, spoke to the eight limbs in a class, and but yeah, the rest of it has, it's been it's very different here at the moment, actually, compared to 10 years ago. Very different. We're quite spoiled.
Yeah. Okay.
In Sydney at the moment.
Interesting. In what respect is it different?
I think there's a lot of yoga. I think there's a lot of competition. I think there's a lot of some of these bigger studios trying to find their way. There's a real emphasis. I guess people are busy, so there's some sort of 55-minute classes, and I call them like melange classes, where they like pull, you know, do a bit of core in there and a bit of like, I've got to get all my things in my one class.
Yeah.
They're really hot and really fast. Really fast. And for me, I think I used to move very fast as a jiva and an ashtangi yogi, but I'm so much slower now, and it's just so hot and fast that my central nervous system was like, I was getting really stressed.
Yeah, I can imagine. It's like the opposite of what we're trying to do. Oh, that's so interesting. And yeah, I guess when there's so much competition, it becomes a business, right? So you're just competing with everyone else. Interesting. All right. So, Rach, I mean, we have to talk about it because it's just so important. Tell me about Play School. I want to know everything. I want all of the behind the scenes info.
Okay. So the first thing that I love to tell people is that, particularly parents, I write the episodes as well.
Amazing.
And if your child watches Play School, you should not feel like an ounce of guilt, because the amount of work that goes into writing every single episode is pretty phenomenal. I have a meeting when I write one episode. There'll be like five eps in a series, and we choose something that needs to be explored for early learning at that point in time. So maybe it's coding, or maybe it's faces and feelings, because parents are all looking at screens now, so they have to teach their kids to look at faces because they're not looking at faces.
Wow. And yeah.
And so we will have a meeting for one episode of those five. So five episodes exploring a particular theme. And I will meet with two early learning specialists and the producer for 2 hours.
Wow.
And they've already kind of mapped out the ideas of what will be in that particular episode. And then I go away and I spend about 2 weeks tinkering with it. And that's just like one half an hour. There is so much work that goes into it. So that's the first
crazy.
Thing.
That's crazy. So that's not just your segment. You'll write an episode. God, I haven't watched Play School in a while.
Yeah,
but there's different episode. Hosts coming in and out. Still?
So that one episode would have two people in it, right?
Okay.
So it goes for 30 minutes.
Yeah.
And there'd be a male and a female host. So wow. For every 30-minute episode, there is that much work that goes into
That's
it.
That's incredible. I mean, I'd never put any thought into it, but I wouldn't have thought that that's what was going on.
Yeah, it's quite complex, and a lot of time and energy and research and all sorts of stuff goes into it. That's the first thing. And then the second thing is, it's like the hardest and the best gig in the world. It's a two-hander, you and another actor performing for 30 minutes. So it's like a mini play, right? 30 minutes singing, making stuff. It's always, they often will shoot big chunks together. So you might be doing 12 pages of dialogue straight.
Okay.
So
yeah, wow.
Got to be on your game, you know, and we shoot really fast. We shoot 30 minutes of TV in about 3.5-4 hours. It's not, we learn it off by heart. You can't just ad lib, and we don't have auto cue. So it is like you have to learn a really, like a big script every time. So it's a lot of work.
Yeah. And do you film a season like in a week or something? Like, do you film them back to back?
No, it's a bit random. We get, because everything gets shot out of like 1.5 studios at the ABC now, really only one studio. We get bumped, if anything else. So say there's an election.
Yeah.
Then there'll be no Play School during the election because there's so much stuff that's being shot in studio, right? Or so we get studio time. We get allocated certain days during the year. And so they'll shoot what we call a block, and a block would be five episodes of a particular series. And so I might only shoot I might myself just shoot one episode every 6 to 8 weeks, and then I might write. This year I've written much less because they've halved the episodes. So they used to shoot 40 eps a year. We now only shoot 20 a year.
Oh, God. And is that a budget funding
thing? Yeah.
That's really sad.
Yeah. So I do write less, which has been a bit of a bummer this year. But because it's spread out between different writers and hosts, it's definitely very sporadic for all of us. So everyone does other stuff.
Mm. Do all of the talent write, or is that no?
No, I think the only other one that does now is Emma Palmer.
Okay.
Yeah, but we both write as well, like in our life. So it's not like I had to fight really hard to get them to let me write. They said no, and like for 2 years, I was like, I'm going to be really good at this. I promise. Let me write you an episode for free, like to show you.
And they're like, no.
Yeah. Yeah, it was funny. It was hard to – but that was one thing that I really chased, because I was like, I really want to do this. I knew it would be great learning for me. I knew that it would be fun. I knew that I knew I had something to offer. And so, yeah, I eventually wore them down. They let me write one for free.
So tell me, how did the Play School gig come up? Was it just another audition that you went to a casting for, or was it something that you'd always wanted to do?
I auditioned for it 7 years before, and I just shaved my head for a role on All Saints, playing a cancer victim.
Wow.
And I didn't get it. I got a call back then, but I didn't get it. And I am not a natural singer. Like, I was never a trained singer. I'm certainly not confident about it. And so I auditioned again 7 years later. They called me back in. I had a lot more work under my belt by then. I think I was very green the first time I auditioned. And I wasn't going to go the callback because I was trying to learn the songs for the callback with my girlfriend Tony, who had her son's little piano. So she's trying to teach me. And I was like, I'm not going to get it. I can't do this. I'm not going to go back. And thank God I did.
Yeah. And how long have you been on Play School now?
9 years almost.
Wow. That's incredible.
I know. It's crazy.
So in that time, you had a child of your own.
Mm.
Does G watch Play School?
He does less now because he's six.
But when he was little?
So when he was little, he's more into, like, you know, Marvel now. Play School's not that cool.
Yeah.
But yes, when he was little, absolutely.
Mm. Sorry, water break. And was it a kick for him to see mum on TV?
I don't think so. I think it was really normal for him. I think, and I don't think he ever saw it as my job, because I remember for his preschool, like, Mother's Day thing, they get them to answer all these questions about their mum. And one of the things was my mum's job is, and he wrote yoga teacher.
Yeah, interesting. Well, I mean, you wear so many hats.
I know, and I guess I'm just going to teach, but he doesn't – I just don't think he sees Play School as, like, you know, my work. Or I think now that he's a little bit older, he's starting to get it, and he's been in studio. He's grown up in theatres and TV studios. But I think he just doesn't see it as my job or something I do. It's just like I'm part of Play School.
Yeah.
Makes sense?
Yeah, I get it. I mean, it's kind of hard to describe careers to children anyway. Like, it doesn't really compute. It's like, I go and do this and I bring home some money and that's how you can eat and go to school. You know?
Yeah.
So it's a lot to take in.
Yeah.
So, Rach, tell us, now you're running this Kickstarter campaign, and I feel like it really incorporates all of the aspects of you that we've been talking about, you know, the performing and the writing and the yoga teaching and the Play School, the kids side of things. Can you tell us a little bit about the project and the campaign behind it?
Yeah, so basically when G was born, I really wanted to find content that was, you know, really beautiful and that was creative and not sterilized, and there wasn't a lot of stuff out there. And part of me had a resistance. I've never wanted to just teach kids yoga. And I think it's because for me, I could always separate my acting and my yoga, right? So it was like, and working with kids, I do a lot of work in communities with kids, and that's when I'm doing this playwriting process. And there was just a separation that I've always had and I liked. But when I was seeking content for him that was had any kind of aspect of mindfulness and yoga and meditation or creativity and storytelling, I just couldn't find anything that I wanted, or that I, there was like a this dream show in my head that didn't exist. So I decided to write the dream show. I met a producer. We met on an ABC show we did together, a little play school spin-off called Joey's Big Adventures. And I met her and we just kind of had a bit of a creative love affair. And I said to her, do you want to collaborate? I want to do a kids' storytime yoga thing. Do you want to collaborate together? And so we've been working on creating a show that's like little bite-sized chunks, so like 7-minute episodes where we're bringing together inspiring imagination through storytelling, and then kids happen to breathe and move their bodies through the story.
Okay.
So it's like sneaky yoga for kids.
We need sneaky yoga for adults. It's like, you're not totally going to a yoga class. Just sit on the floor, listen to this story, and we'll move around a little bit.
Yeah, you roll around the floor, you can pretend to be an animal. It's going to be fun. And when we first started to talk to people about the show, you know, a lot of the advice I was getting was what I knew works in kids' TV land in order to make it work. So it was like, you need to have an animated character. And I was like, but I want the animation to come from the kids' imaginations, depending on what animal they're being. Mm. And I'm like, yeah, but it's easier to kind of commercialize if it's, you know, there's like, I'm like, so every avenue that I went down, I had advice that I totally agree with people, but I just, in terms of it being a commercially viable, potentially make a fortune kids show.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to make something that was really beautiful and that was, that spoke to kids' imaginations. And so I said to Tash, let's just make what we want to make, that what I think will work, what I think will make kids want to go outside and be in nature. Like, let's shoot it outside, shoot them barefoot, shoot them with messy wild hair, not have it be a perfect Zen yoga show. Like, have them make mistakes and fall out of the poses and just be silly and fun, and we'll try and get it up ourselves.
Yeah.
So thus we used our own money to create the pilot, and then I said to her, let's just give a Kickstarter a red hot go, because what it also means is we had interest from investors, but you have to already be then thinking about, from a startup perspective, like, how's the app going to work? How's that? And it started to inform, again, the creative process and limit the audience. And I was like, I want it to be available for kids everywhere in the world all the time.
Mm.
And keeping them kind of shorter episodes, which there's nothing that fits in the children's television landscape for 7-minute content, right? And the digital fund, which exists, which would be perfect for where, because even though there's narrative, they consider us lifestyle because there's a mindfulness component.
Wow.
So if it was just silly, silly narrative, we probably could have funding. But I said to Tash, let's just not compromise. Let's make something that is going to, like, I think the biggest crisis in the world today is mental health.
Mm.
It is, like, all of the big issues we have, whether it's in Australia, domestic violence, all of the terrorist acts, like, so much of these things, you knuckle it down, you pull it back the layers, and there's an element of mental health at play.
Mm.
And from the smallest everyday kids dealing with anxiety to the extreme acts of violence that are happening in the world, it's a crisis. I would say that for young people today, and it's getting much, much younger, the statistics are really alarming. How many kids feel anxious, how many kids are suffering from anxiety, how many kids are suffering from depression. And I'm talking not just what do they call it when we have a depression that's triggered by an event. This is like a mental condition that they're having every day at school. It's not just triggered by individual events. Kids are walking around in this with a cloud hanging over their heads, and I think that's I think it's really sad, and I think there's so much stuff we can do to change that. And part of it is getting kids to move their bodies, getting kids to come into their imagination, getting them to trust themselves, to have a little bit of self-confidence, self-worth, and they feel like very big psychology terms, but actually by you just getting kids to balance on one leg and while pretending to be a tree, we're actually tackling these huge, huge issues. Mm. And I think that's kind of remarkable in a way that let's just simplify it. Let's just simplify it. Just get kids to move a bit, be animals again, be silly, have fun. And we're potentially addressing what I think is the biggest crisis. If not right now, it's certainly going to be by the time my son is a young adult.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So tell me about the Kickstarter itself. How much money do you need to raise and what does that money go towards?
So we need to raise $158,000. It'll give us...
That's a lot of money.
A lot of money.
Yeah.
So it'll give us... it depends. It'll give us at least 7 episodes because we've already spent the money to pay for the pilot episode. The kinds of things that it goes towards is animation, post-production, camera guys, makeup people, designers. We're shooting on location. It's not heavy in terms of props, but it's all of the post-production and actual shooting stuff that gets really expensive.
Yeah.
So we did the budget and we were like, the only way that we'll be able to do this is either do the Kickstarter and not just have, like, my community have been incredible, the yoga community in Sydney. I can't even tell you. My students have been phenomenal. But it has to go wider. Like, if we don't get wider, we need, like, 2,000 people, not our gorgeous little 80.
Yeah,
80
of course.
People, you know. So that's, it was never going to be just a little Kickstarter that we do with our local community and we can get it up. It was very ambitious.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think it's possible, right? So for people that don't know how Kickstarters work, you pledge a certain amount of money.
For us, we're doing like $20, you get the pilot. $50, you get all of the apps. We'll make a minimum of 6 new ones plus the pilot, but hopefully we'll be able to make more. And then there are bigger packages for experience. You know, if you want to pay more, you can come to the premiere. But the fundamental package the pledge that we really want lots of people to do is you're basically paying to get the show before it gets made.
Yeah, which is amazing. It's like your money's obviously going towards a great cause, but also you're getting something in return. So it's not like it's money that's just disappearing. They're actually purchasing the show pretty much.
Yes.
Yeah, which is
incredible. And they'll get early access. So the rest of the world won't get to see it for 6 months. Our backers will get to have it first.
Okay, so let's say you hit your mark, you make this show, then what happens? Do you shop it around to networks or do you release it on YouTube? Like, how does it work?
My goal is to have it be available to everyone everywhere in the world. So I would love to either create a platform like YouTube or an app that can be downloaded, but so that it's not just sitting in one place. So, because that's the big thing for me is like, how do we just get it to as many kids as possible, as accessibly as possible, so that parents can hand over an iPad without feeling guilty and they can spend an hour wherever they are, if they're traveling, if they're at home, if they're in the car, wherever they are, they can watch. And the other thing about it is that for me, I'm like, how do we build a global community as well of younger yogis? That would be exciting if in the longer run, once the show gets made, we have a platform that connects little yogis. Mm. Because I know the power of the yoga community globally for grown-ups. Like, it's a really amazing thing. You walk into a studio anywhere in the world and you feel like you're part of something,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
you read someone's blog, you listen to someone's podcast, or you, I don't know, you feel, I just feel like I'm part of this really beautiful, powerful global community, being part of the yoga community. So I think it'd be very cool to, in the longer run, develop that, like a little hub that is universal, easily accessible, and just something that inspires kids and gets them to love who they are, to feel strong and empowered and calm, and deal with this crazy ass world they're going to be living in.
No, could not agree more. And the idea of a little community just for them. I mean, and that's something, I mean, I'm not a parent, but I imagine as a parent, that's the kind of community you'd want them hanging out in.
Totally.
Yeah. Okay, so what can people do if they want to help you out with this? What's the first move?
They can jump on board. The Kickstarter campaign is called Rachel and the Minis. It's on my link in my bio on my Insta.
I'll put it on the website.
And you can see that you can all the pledges are there. You just do $20 for the pilot, or your $50 to get the whole series. And at the moment, we're sitting at about 82 backers, I think. And we've already, just from that little group of people, we're on like almost 15 grand.
Yeah, I just looked at it before.
I know.
Do you, if you don't reach your target, do you still get whatever's been pledged?
No. Oh, it all goes back. It goes back to the people who pledged, and we get zero.
Oh, God. That's horrible. So you have to reach I am really sad. Guys, we have to help. So you have to reach the target in order to get anything. Otherwise, you get nothing. Oh, Rach, I wish I was a millionaire. I'd just give you all the money. If you guys are interested, people listening, if you're interested, if you have kids that you know this will benefit, then even just a $50 pledge would be so helpful if we can get the numbers up.
And the thing is, because we've shot a pilot, when you have a look at the Kickstarter video, you get a really good sense of the show.
Yeah, it's great.
And do you like how funny is Gabriel?
He's so cute. But I think all the kids are so cute. So I felt like I was watching one of those, you know, one of those shows where it's like silly things 4-year-olds say, even though I know they're like older than that, 9-year-olds. But yeah, it was very cute, very sweet. I think I'd watch it as someone without kids.
Well, I think you should. I'll send you the pilot. Yeah. You can watch do it in your lounge room.
I will. I do lots of stuff in this lounge room. So what happened? Let's just, you know, worst case scenario. What happens if you don't get this money? What do you do with it then?
So if we don't get this money, there's two things going on. The first thing is my beautiful collaborator and creative soulmate, Tash, is pregnant. So she is going to have a baby in January. So we were trying to do this all before she does that. If she has a baby in January, we're going to have a couple of months to just take a breath. And then we'll rethink. We'll have to go down the road of looking at speaking to brands and speaking to investors again. And that's not, you know, that's not, we're not ruling that out. This was just a way for us to have a little bit of control over getting it made quickly. And getting it made in a way that I can just get it to everyone without any kind of restraints. There's so many restraints once you get, and it's no one's fault. It's just the way that networks are now. That's the landscape of this new landscape of television and the digital world. There's so many constraints on people with what can and can't get made. Mm. And so we just have to look at down the road changing things. And you know, that's okay. I feel like we have put everything into this show. I've put definitely the past 6 years there's been work into it. We shot the pilot a year ago. We spent the past year doing our research, meeting with people, looking at all the options. None of this has been, you know, kind of fast and furious. So if the Kickstarter doesn't work, I said to Tash, it's okay, but we know we've given it our best. Like, we've done everything we can to do it our way and you know, to do it our way and to really make the show we wanted to make and get it out to the whole world. Yeah.
Love it. Love it. All right. Well, we'll do the best that we can.
Thanks, George.
Listeners.
You're the best.
Yeah, well, I hope so. I'd really love to pull this one off for you, Rach. That would be so good. I have one more thing to ask you. Yeah. Have you ever looked at your own Wikipedia page?
Oh, God. Not for a while.
Well, I think that you need to talk to someone and they need to put a new picture of you up.
Because, it's still the pregnant picture.
Yeah, you're heavily pregnant in the picture. Weird. And it's just such a strange picture to put of you.
So weird, isn't it?
Yeah.
I know.
And I also wonder how much of your page is true. I mean, it all seemed legit, but I've known many a false Wikipedia page.
Once we get off this, I'm going to have a look and I'm going to talk to my people.
Okay, I think you should.
I don't really have people anymore, but I'm going to find some people.
Find some people to sort that out, because it's the first thing that comes up when I Google you. I just wasn't impressed by the way they portrayed you at all.
I love it. Can you be my PR person?
Absolutely.
Can you just sort that out, George?
Yeah, no worries. All right, Rach, thank you so much for chatting to me, especially while you're on holidays in LA.
Thank you. I'm not really on holidays. I have been doing a lot of work by the pool, but I've been by the pool.
Oh, so. By the pool, exactly. Amazing. thank you. And we will do our best. As a podcast community, we will do our best. And I wish you all the luck.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.